Welcome to Jury Duty. I'm your host, Chris Terracone. This season of Jury Duty explores the trial of Michael Barrisone, who is charged with the attempted murders of Lauren Kanarek and Robert Goodwin in Long Valley, New Jersey. Kanarek was struck in the chest by two bullets from Barrisone's weapon, and, as it was undisputed that Barrisone fired those shots, his legal team argued that he was not guilty because he was legally insane at the time of the shooting, and, in the alternative, because he fired those shots in self-defense. In our last episode, we began to explore the testimony of Charles Hassan, a psychologist who observed and performed tests on Michael Barrisone within 3 months of the shooting. On today's installment, we continue our look at the testimony of Dr. Hassan. That's all coming up right after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's approaching mid-afternoon on April 6th, 2022, day 8 of the Barrisone trial. Edward Blankus continues his direct examination of Dr. Charles Hassan, whose testimony as a psychologist supplements the testimony of psychiatrist Dr. Stephen Simring regarding the defendant's mental state. In the first part of his testimony, Dr. Hassan told the jurors about validity testing that he performed on Michael Barrisone to determine whether the defendant was feigning his mental afflictions. Blankus follows up on that testimony with more questions about how the witness came to verify the validity of his empirical observations.
Any other validity testing?
Well, there was two others. I did two other personality tests. They look at personality from a different perspective.
And why did you look at a personality test in evaluating Michael Barrisone?
Well, for the simple reason, if you're a forensic psychologist or psychiatrist or whoever it might be, you want to make sure that you're not being misled, having your own biases. You want to look at the person you're interacting with, and you don't want to be skewed in a certain direction. So I like to do a lot of testing to see if I'm missing something. So the tests have validity scales. I might say, well, someone is perfectly, you know, well or not. And if the testing comes out in a different way, I have to scratch my head and look more deeply.
Did you do any personality tests? And if so, what specific tests did you do?
Well, as I mentioned, I did the MMPI, the Rorschach, the PAI. They all look at abnormal aspects of personality. But I wanted to compare it to other tests that look at normal personality.
And why,
because
why did you want to look at that?
Because I wanted to check on my own views to see if I was accurate, to see if these other tests were accurate. It's called construct validity. I wanted to check it out.
And what does that mean? Explain that to the jury.
Well, there's a concept in psychology called multi-trait matrix. And what that means is you want to give multiple measures from different situations and to see if they all agree with each other, right? If there's agreement, you can say, well, you know what? That may be an accurate finding. And so it's a check. I do the testing as a check on myself and also a check on the test. The two other tests that I gave measure normal traits. If you have an excess or a low amount of a certain trait, it can cause psychological problems. Those two tests agreed with the MMPI and the PAI and also the Rorschach. Basically, on the 16PF, it's developed on a factor analysis approach. But anyway, there were four elevations on that test, if I'm recalling, you know, clearly. One was called Q4, has a very high level of anxiety and depression. Another was a very low score on C. This test divides all of the scores in tenths. There's 10, 1, 2, 3, there's 10 of them. If you have a score of 1 or a score of 10, that's a very elevated score either way. Now, the score that on C was emotional instability. He had a score of 1, which is similar to the Rorschach and similar to the other tests, that he's unstable emotionally. He could be emotionally upset a little more easily than other people.
And did the tests that you testified to so far all coincide with each other as far as the bottom line results?
Yeah, they did.
And what does that tell you from a practitioner standpoint?
Emotionally unstable. Other tests indicate that he could easily be moved into a psychotic state. Psychotic state is just a break with reality. Some of the tests show that he has very idiosyncratic thinking. The Rorschach showed the over-inclusive thinking. It's a technical term, but all it simply means that if you meet with Michael Barrison and you're talking with him, it's really hard to do a clinical interview with him because he's all over the place.
Did you do any cognitive tests?
Yes, I did.
And again, why would you do a cognitive test in a psychiatric evaluation?
Because when I came in and I tried to interview him, and by the way, the reason I did it over seven sessions was it's very hard for someone to play act over a long period of time. If you see someone who's play acting, there's a movement towards normality as time goes on because it's hard to keep up the act. There was no change with him. He was crying, sobbing. At one point, the officer who was outside, he called me over and said, "Are you okay?" Because he heard him like ranting and raving. He was very upset. And because of that, I suspect that he had some kind of problem, you know, neurologically or with attention or whatever it might be. So I decided to investigate that.
Okay, and is that why you did cognitive tests?
Yes.
What specific cognitive tests did you do?
Well, first, I gave a full IQ test because it could tell you if he has deficits in certain areas. The test is called the Wechsler Intelligence Scale, and there's a part on it that measures verbal abilities, nonverbal ability, working memory, where you could do two things at the same time, whistle and, play guitar. I'm being facetious. But it measures two cognitive things at the same time, psychomotor speed, and it also gives a full-scale IQ. I gave that. I found out that on that testing, he has a problem with working memory. It's a variation of attention. And then I also checked out his verbal IQ is up here, and his working memory is over here. It's 20 points lower.
What does that tell you from a...
It's a relative deficit in working memory, attention.
And how does that relate to your evaluation?
Well,
here?
And I also asked him about his childhood. He said that he always had trouble maintaining focus in school, right? But I noticed that when he'd be talking to me, he would be repeating himself constantly as if like he couldn't remember what he just said. And then he'd be all over the place. And it was very hard to keep up with him. So the way I did it was, I ignored any extra talk, and I wrote down phrase by phrase, and then when I came back to it, I said, "Well, you just said such and such," and I continued that way. It was a little bit more tedious, but I can get a comprehensive interview done with him. Now, because I saw that there was a problem with working memory and aspects of attention, so like, for example, if you say to him, "Give me digits forward," he could do pretty well on that, five or seven. Between five and seven digits forward. And then I said, "Do it backwards, 2, 4. He's supposed to say 4, 2. He could only do 3. For someone who is as intelligent, he's an intelligent person, intelligent as him, it was a low score. So then I looked at attention, and I gave one test to check out attention, and his score was the CPT, the Connors Continuous Performance Test. He scored so low on it, I was surprised. So I gave it to him 3 times. And he scored as if he was neurologically impaired with an intentional problem or, you know, a diagnosis of ADHD. I didn't stand on that test alone. So I also gave another test called the ACT. It's an auditory consonant test. So it's something like this. You say to the person 3 consonants, like I'm just making this up, A, B, C. And then you say 200. And the person has to count backwards by 3s, 200, 197, 194, 191, all the way back. Then you get to either 9 or 18 or 36 seconds. You say, "What were the 3 words? And usually the person would say ABC. With Michael, he scored at the first and the second percentile level. It was a low score. Then also,
what does that low score tell you?
He has an attentional problem. He's all over the place. He's like scattered. The scattered quality he has, I started picking up when I was talking with him. He'd be saying to me, "Wait a minute, I got to tell you this, I got to tell you that." And his thoughts were not linear. It wasn't like he was following, you know, in a way that I could follow easily. It was difficult, you know, to follow.
And what could cause someone to score and react like that?
It's hard to say 100% because he has had a fracture of the skull when he was age 8. He also had 8 to 12 concussions, falling from a horse. Dr. Picardo mentioned to me that he also fell when he was roofing his house, and she said that he was too macho to want to go into the hospital. He used to do a lot of construction around his property, but it could be from the fall. It could be some other developmental problem, right? I don't know, but he has an attentional problem, and his thoughts are scattered.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
After asking Dr. Hassan about the source of Michael Barrisone's attention deficit, defense attorney Edward Bolinkis moves on to inquire about the witness's observations of the defendant in the aftermath of the shooting of Ms. Kanorak.
In reviewing the discovery, did you review the injury that Michael Barrisone suffered in this incident?
Yes.
What, if any, impact could they have had on his psychological testing?
He has no memory for the incident. And in my report, I noted a reputable neuropsychiatrist, Cummings, from California. He gave two examples. He said that Gene Tunney, who was a prize fighter who fought against Dempsey, he dropped out of boxing because he started having amnesia, periodic bouts of amnesia. And then the doctor gave an example of another prize fighter who was fighting a fight. And from the fourth round on, he didn't even know he won the fight until hours later he had to be told. So he was, to me, he looked like he lost a mixed martial art fight. He had severe bruising in his face. He had bleeding under the left ear, I think bleeding from the right eye. He looked like he had was given a workout. Now, it's possible that the beating, you know, affected his memory. I can't say 100%, but it may have impaired what they call consolidation.
Would his previous head injuries that you mentioned impact on a subsequent have an impact on subsequent beating?
Yes, because if you're like a prize fighter and you get beaten a lot of times, let's say later in life you hit your head, it could have more of an impact than if it was the first time. The more prior blows to the head, especially in the front of the face or wherever you got hurt, it's going to have a greater impact than just one beating.
Did you test for executive function?
Yes.
What are executive functions?
Well, the executive functions, I tried to look at it like differently. Executive functions are like organization, planning, things of that sort. He scored well on that. I also gave him a test among the executive functions that picks up if there's some form of brain damage, either acute or diffuse. He didn't have any problems with that. The only thing that I did notice in terms of executive functions is that he has some kind of nonverbal visual problem. And like if you ask him to draw a pattern, a complex pattern, he doesn't draw the outside. He draws like a little bit of it. It's as if he has trouble forming a visual picture of something. I don't know if that's from and it's unusual. I don't know if that's from the head trauma or what, but people who tend to have some kind of executive dysfunction, sometimes when they try to do a task, they don't organize it. His was like all over the place in that regards.
Any other tests?
All right. So because he claimed that he had amnesia for the event, first of all, I also wanted to do validity testing. So the most important validity testing for cognitive is the VIP, and it showed no feigning on either.
When you say validity testing, you administered a specific test to determine whether or not Michael Barrisone was feigning.
Faking,
not remembering the event.
I wanted to see, because people who are feigning, they typically try to claim all manner of memory impairment. They overplay their hand. He didn't do that. His memory was not terrible or anything of that sort. And on the VIP, it came out that he was honest and genuine. Except, I have to say this, on one part of the VIP, is a nonverbal part, it indicated there's a computer program on there that he had trouble maintaining his attention on the nonverbal part of the test. But even with that, it came out that he was conclusively genuine in how he responded. He showed effort and intent to do well on that test.
And what does that have to do with your opinion as to whether or not he's feigning?
He wasn't feigning memory impairment, and if he's claiming that he can't remember, I tend to buy what he's saying, except that I don't know if it's psychogenic. I put down it's a dissociative amnesia from stress, but it could be from the beating, it could be from the prior head injuries, or what?
So it could be either from a physical injury or from a mental injury.
Yes. And if I might interject, I just read a recent review article that it was from a university in Holland. The program is like criminology there. And they studied 20 years of worldwide claims of dissociative disorder. They looked at the studies themselves. And the problem is that the people who did the studies, they didn't rule out TBI. A lot of the people had like...
What's TBI?
Traumatic brain injury. They had mild traumatic brain injury. And they didn't rule that out as the reason the person couldn't remember. So in his case, I put down that he had an emotional type of loss of memory, but he also had, you have to keep in mind that he had a beating.
Did you do any memory tests?
Yes, I did. And
and why did you do a memory test when you were evaluating Michael Barrisone's state of mind at the time of the incident?
Well, I wanted to see if he had some kind of significant brain damage that can influence the results. And like I just said, that people who are feigning amnesia or memory impairment, they tend to overplay their hand. So they have memory impairment all over the place. His actually was very specific in one little area, and that was nonverbal memory.
And were there any validity portions of those tests?
Well, the validity was the VIP. I also did another test called the CVLT, and I also did another test called the TOM. The CVLT is a list learning test, and it has a validity component built into it. The bottom line is that he was not feigning on that test. On the TOM, which is nonverbal memory, recognition memory, he had a poor score.
What does that indicate to you?
I didn't know whether it was from the fact that he had a problem with nonverbal memory or what. But, you know, he was given four tests. Three out of the four came out fine. The VIP is the most powerful one of those different tests.
And how did he come out on
fine.
That?
He was not feigning.
Did you do any perceptual tests?
I did.
Which ones?
Well, the tests that I gave were from the NAB, that's the Neuropsychological Assessment Battery. So you have a whole bunch of tests on that. Then I supplemented that with some other tests that I gave. I gave a test called the Ray Complex Figure Test. On that test, I saw that he worked very piecemeal in terms of putting things together. He also has a memory component on that. He scored poorly in terms of memory for nonverbal. His perceptual functioning was borderline in a couple of tests. I don't know if I did more assessment with him, which I thought was like, I didn't see the utility of it, but, you know, maybe I could determine exactly what the problem is with the nonverbal functioning.
And finally, did you do any tests with respect to language?
I did.
And why would you test... give him language.
Because you have a beating to your front of your head, and this is like the frontal area of the skull. It could damage your verbal production. So if you say to an individual, I'm going to give you 60 seconds and tell me as many words that begin with the letter F-A-F-A-S. First with F. Don't give me people's names like Fernando. Don't give me places like France. Don't give me numbers like 5. And you total it up. There's tables that are based on age, education, ethnicity. And he scored very fine. Average score is between 12 to 15 words per minute. And he was like 18 per minute. So from the beating he had, it didn't affect that language production area.
You testified to a great number of tests that you administer. Were the tests consistent with each other?
The tests were consistent in showing no feigning on personality or cognitive.
What else did the test indicate to you based on your score?
The test indicate that he suffers from paranoia, delusional disorder of a very high level, and that it's very significant.
Right. Now, did you review Dr. Simmering's evaluation?
Yes, I did.
And did you review that stack of 91 pages that were provided to
Yes.
you?
I put down 51, but I don't know exactly what the number is for the simple reason I did count 91, but then I noticed in the pages themselves that there were duplicates. So I didn't actually count the clean pages. So I don't know if it's 51, 77, or 91. The total that I went through was 91, but there's duplicates in there.
Now, did you review any discovery that was provided by the prosecutor's office?
Yes, I went over the police reports, Morris County Department's reports, the hospital reports, the EMT reports, the emergency room reports, the orthopedic reports.
Did you review any social media posts?
Oh, yes. This was rough because there were like six boxes of Facebook posts, like over 20,000. I went through a number of them, but I didn't record all that I went through on my list. But there's one box for Mr. Goodwin. I think it's 2,000 or so items. I also went over text messaging back and forth between different parties.
With regards to the social media posts, did you talk to Michael Barrison about various posts that he saw that Lauren Cantorac posted about him?
Yes.
Did you discuss any posts where she talked about going to war?
Yes.
What, if any, impact did those posts have on Michael Barrison?
Well, he's calm right now, but when I was talking with him, he was like petrified. He was frightened when he read, and I read him the post to see what it was like, you know, how he reacted. He was frightened.
Did you go over a post where Cantorac talked about weapons, guns?
Yes, I also saw pictures she had.
And what specific effect did that have on Michael Barrison?
He was super frightened. He remained super frightened. On one of the times that I was there when I was leaving, he said to me that he wanted the judge if he was freed.
Objection, judge.
Don't say anything about the judge. I'll move on, judge.
Okay.
The question's withdrawn.
In the discovery that you reviewed, did you discuss the fact that Lauren Cantorac was tape recording Michael Barrison?
Yes.
And did you discuss what impact that recording was having on his mental state?
He was incredibly frightened. He had no refuge, no place to go where he felt safe. He was very upset. He said, this is an example of a terrorist, you know. He was frightened, you know, tremendous amount. And it upset him that she had a post that she referred to him and the other people there scurrying around, going into their car, you know, to speak to each other. But he was just very frightened.
What impact does someone thinking, whether it's true or not, that every word that you say is being listened to?
Judge, I'm going to object to the general nature of the question.
I think it's a little broad.
Rephrase it,
please.
What effect is Michael Barrison thinking that every word that he spoke to anyone was being recorded by someone that he was afraid of?
It made him super paranoid, that everything he was doing was being monitored. Not only being recorded, he thought that he was being filmed.
Did you review posts with him where Lauren Cantorac was telling people on Facebook that Michael Barrison was threatening her life?
That super, super frightened him, super, because he has distorted thinking. So here's what his thinking was like. He said to me that the Parkland shooting person stated that he was bullied. Then he said, Cantorac said, she's bullied. So then he said, my conclusion is she's going to kill me just like the Parkland shooter. His deduction was off. But that's how he came up with that.
Did you discuss with him numerous contacts that he made with people who Cantorac had previously posted things on Facebook about?
Yes.
For instance, the name Staggart and Parkinson.
I remember that.
Now, I don't want you to say what those posts contained, but did you discuss those posts with Michael Barrison?
Yes.
What did he say about those posts, and what was their effect on his mental state?
Well, the effect was it made him even more frightened. He saw how other people were treated, and he thought that there was a greater danger. And he actually admitted that to me. So I asked him about, like, you know, how things transpired to cause him all this difficulty. And he says, well, it was the pattern of everything that came his way. He looked up, he got information on Cantorac, her behavior, and everything together made him more and more frightened. But he felt as if there was a realistic threat out there.
Now, did you discuss with him leaving his residence a week or so before the incident?
Yes.
What did he indicate to you was the reason that he left?
He feared for his life.
Who was he living there with?
With Mary Haskins and I think for a time her son.
And where did he go after he fled his residence?
He went to the recreation room at the stable. It was a large room that was furnished that had a kitchen area there and place to sleep. And he moved in there. A reception area, that's what it was called.
Did Michael Barisone, based on your discussions with him and the discovery that he reviewed, take any steps to try to protect himself?
He was frightened. He felt as if when he'd be talking to either Mary Haskins or someone else, that Kanarak was quoting directly what he was saying. And he got more and more scared, you know. And what he did was he hired someone to sweep the barn area to see if they could find any of the tape recorders.
I'm going to show you D-700-2. Did you review this in your discovery?
Yes, I did.
What is that?
This is a contract for debugging. It's, I think, $5,000 and of the certain area of the barn.
Did Michael Barisone hire anyone else?
Well, he hired a person to watch overnight and to sit in his SUV.
And why did he hire that person?
Because he was fearful, because he was saying that Lauren Kanarak and Rob Goodwin, they'd be wandering around at night, in the middle of the night, and he was fearful that they were going to do something.
Do what?
Burn the barn down, harm people. And when he stayed at the reception area, he made sure that all the windows and doors were locked.
Did he do anything else to protect himself? Did he hire a private investigator?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. He hired a private investigator to find out if they had a prior arrest record. And that upset him, too, because he saw...
Okay. We cannot go into the specifics, but 700A-1, is this the background check that you talked to Michael Barisone about?
Yes.
And can you tell the jury what impact Michael Barisone getting this document from the private investigator had on his mental state?
It intensified the fear factor. He felt as if that there was a whole bunch of information that was pointing in the direction that these are dangerous people.
Did Michael Barisone ever call the police?
Yes, he did.
Approximately how many times?
Approximately four times.
And did you discuss those specific instances with him?
Yes, I did.
And what did he indicate to you with regards to each and every one of those instances?
Total frustration. He was trying to say how scared he was. He felt as if they were poo-pooing it, and he had no place to turn. That's how he felt. He had no recourse.
And what did that do to his psychic?
He felt alone. He felt vulnerable. He felt as if he couldn't fight back, so to speak.
At some point, was he told that the Morris County Prosecutor's Office was consulted?
Yes.
Did anything happen with regards to them consulting about this incident, based on your review of the discovery?
The AP reviewed the information that Michael found upsetting, and they didn't find it of sufficient type to follow through with any kind of action. It basically told him that it was a landlord-tenant difficulty.
When Michael Barisone heard that, both from the police and the prosecutor's office, what effect did it have on him?
Felt more vulnerable. He had no protection.
Now, did Michael Barisone talk to you about his knowledge of Goodwin and Kanarak's drug use?
Yes.
I'm not going to ask you specifics, but did that play any role in Michael Barisone's mental state with regards to your evaluation?
Yes. He felt
and
both.
How so?
He felt both of them were unstable to begin with, and he thought with the drug use that they're even more unstable. And then, if I recall correctly, he spoke to someone who thought that drugs might be planted on his vehicle, and he got even more scared.
And in addition to that information, did you talk to Michael Barisone about Lauren Kanarak posting things on social media indicating that she had mental or psychological problems?
Yes.
Did you discuss that with Michael?
I did.
And what impact did that have on his mental state?
Everything was drip, drip, drip of making him more frightened. He particularly was frightened when she essentially said that she had multiple personalities and she could not be responsible. Then he combined that with images he saw of her, where there were gun images, statements that she made about shooting at people who tried to...
Objection, Judge.
Okay.
All right, sustained, Mr. Belenkis, as previously discussed.
Did Michael Barrisone talk to you about an incident where Robert Goodwin made some gesture with his finger?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What specifically did he tell you about that?
He said on August 6th, when the people from Washington Township came to his place, it was like three different people, a number of cars that came up. He said Rob Goodwin was 15 feet away, and he placed his hand in the form of a gun to his head. And said words to the effect, watch out, or something like that. And he smiled on his face.
What did Michael Barrisone say about that smile to you?
He said it scared him because he remembered something that happened a long time ago when he was a little boy. He was sexually assaulted by someone. And he says, oh, I saw the same kind of eyes, the frightening eyes. They scared him. The same thing when he had trouble with his mother when she burnt his hand. It was the same kind of eyes, and it made him frightened. It was just fearful of them.
Did you review the police reports with regards to the day of the incident?
Yes.
Did you review the reports regarding DCPP's contact with Mary Haskins and Michael Barrisone?
Yes.
Now, what did Michael Barrisone tell you with regards to what he heard during that meeting with DCPP?
The only thing I thought he said that he heard the word of sexual abuse and that he was worried that the family would be broken up, the children taken away. He had a distorted view that if the children were taken, if he and Mary Haskins were arrested, his biggest fear, which is, this is completely delusional. His biggest fear, I think, is delusional. His biggest fear was that Lauren Kanarak and Rob Goodwin would kill the children. And he linked it up with seeing some posts where they were trying to get information on the two children. But he was frightened.
Judge, objection. There's no evidence of that.
See you at sidebar.
With Judge Taylor calling for a sidebar conference, we bring to a close this episode of Jury Duty, the trial of Michael Barrisone. Join us on our next installment as we continue our look at the testimony of psychologist Dr. Charles Hassan. If you would like to listen to these episodes early and ad-free, head over to our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You can find more information about this trial on our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page or at crimestory.com. Jury Duty is created and produced by Carrie Antholis. It was co-produced and edited by yours truly, Chris Terracone. Music for this episode was provided by Strike Audio, and the trial audio is courtesy of Law & Crime Networks. Thank you for joining us. We hope you'll come back for the next episode of Jury Duty, the trial of Michael Barrisone.